Four times more choice parents rated their child's school an A, 42%, than did the public school parents, only 10%. And there's more. A 1999 survey by Public Agenda, a nonpartisan research group, found that 68% of blacks favor vouchers, reported Michael Leo Owens of Emory University in an excellent New York Times op-ed explaining why support for school choice is strong and rising among African Americans. A similar poll by the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, a nonpartisan think tank, showed that the percentage of blacks supporting school vouchers rose to 60% in 1999 from 48% in 1996. Owens went on to concede that his younger generation, quote, knows that vouchers have severe limitations. We recognize that no voucher program can save a failing public system. Poorly funded vouchers don't offer much of a chance for poor children to enroll in expensive alternative schools. Vouchers can't ensure parental involvement in education, and vouchers can't end the resistance of many suburban schools to black enrollment. However, he concluded, vouchers offer the only hope available to many students trapped in the nation's worst schools. For a limited number of children, they may make a crucial difference. That possibility is enough for black parents to take a chance. Want more evidence? Come right here to New York and tucked away in a little corner, largely unheralded by modern liberal elitists, you'll find a few brilliant little gems. In the early 1970s, public schools in Harlem were horrific. They were so bad that administrators were ready to throw up their hands and give up. So when a handful of teachers and principals in District 4 asked if they could reorganize part of their school district into small, independently run, alternative public schools from which neighborhood parents could choose to send their children, even liberal bureaucrats didn't have the heart to say no. After all, what harm could it do? The voucher movement hadn't really gathered steam yet, and no private, parochial, or otherwise religious school would be allowed to participate. It wasn't exactly the brand of school choice that I prefer, but it was a step forward, and it worked. Read the wonderful book, Miracle in East Harlem, The Fight for Choice in the Public Education System by Seymour Fliegel and James McGuire. Dig through the newspaper clippings of these remarkable, innovative schools. Schools where just a little more freedom than traditional public schools has paid such big and valuable dividends in the lives of children and their parents, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Kids are learning in Harlem. They're being prepared for life. They're being given a chance to dream dreams and pursue them. Oprah Winfrey came to Harlem in June of 2001 to deliver the commencement speech to the Young Women's Leadership School, part of the Miracle in East Harlem. The school was started by Ann Tisch, a former NBC News reporter who got intrigued by the education reforms going on in Milwaukee. So she quit her job, rolled up her sleeves, and dedicated herself to creating a school with a different way of doing things. And Tisch's school is an all-girls school. That's right, no guys, just girls, an all-girls public school. All are minorities, 60% are Hispanic, 40% black. Most are poor. This is Harlem, not Manhattan. Most come from broken and disadvantaged families. Many are the children of single mothers. But because Tisch and her team have been given just a little more freedom than the usual public school teachers and principals, they've been able to design a school that works and thus attracts the trust of parents who choose to send their daughters there. Liberals, of course, hated the idea of an all-girls public school, which supposedly discriminated against boys. They hated the fresh breeze of creativity and innovation. So the New York Civil Liberties Union sued to shut the school down. Fortunately, they lost. And I say fortunately because the school is already having tremendous results. Everyone in the school's first senior class will graduate, reported the New York Daily News. All except one will go to a four-year college. The exception is joining the Air Force. More than 80% of the girls, grades 7 to 12, read at or above their grade level. Citywide, less than 50% do. On the English Regents, that's a statewide exam, 100% of the girls passed versus 42% citywide. On the Spanish and Math Regents, 100% passed, 97% passed the Biology Regents, and 94% passed the Global Studies Regents. At my old school, the kids didn't care, the teachers were burned out, and the parents weren't involved, said 18-year-old Monica Diaz, once a D student, now a college-bound success story. Before coming to this school, I had never even written an essay or knew what one was. This school definitely changed my life. I could go on, but the point is simple and clear. Where it's being tried, school choice is working. It's giving parents more control, more involvement, and more peace of mind. It's giving teachers and principals more ownership and opportunity for improvement. And more importantly, it's helping students do better academically. And isn't that what we want in American education? Isn't that the whole point? Yes, school choice programs are relatively new. Yes, relatively few students have been allowed to participate. But so far, the news is very good. Few issues are more important to our economic strength and security than unfettered access to reasonably priced oil and gas, the lifeblood of any industrial society. Remember when Arab nations slapped that oil embargo on the United States in 1973 to punish us for our support of Israel? Energy prices here skyrocketed. Our economy plunged into the toilet. It took us years to recover from the ensuing recession. Remember, too, how Islamic extremists seized control of Iran in 1979, triggering a new wave of oil shortages, price spikes, gas lines, and the worst economy since the Great Depression with Jimmy Carter's infamous misery index. Then, of course, there was the recent energy crisis in California, spurring massive blackouts, price spikes, and serious hardships. Well, none of us wants to repeat the costly mistakes of the not-too-distant past. Yet if we follow the left down this path, that's precisely what will happen. Now more than ever, particularly in the wake of 9/11, the American people deserve facts, not fanaticism. And the fact is that America is more dependent than ever on importing foreign oil. Back during the Arab oil embargo, the U.S. imported only 36% of our oil needs. 30 years later, well, that number has skyrocketed to almost 60%. Worse, a higher and higher percentage of that oil is coming from the Persian Gulf region. In 1973, less than 14% of our total foreign oil imports came from the Persian Gulf. By the year 2000, that number had climbed to more than 22%, making us increasingly more dependent on a hostile and volatile region to keep our economy humming. The Clinton-Gore administration actually increased our dependence on foreign oil, and particularly on oil imported from the hotbed of Islamic radicalism. Between 1993 and 2000, U.S. oil imports from the Persian Gulf increased by more than 38%, from less than 1.8 million barrels a day to more than 2.4 million barrels a day. Worse still, when Clinton and Gore took office, we imported no oil from Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, but by the time they left office, we were importing more than 600,000 barrels a day from Iraq. The U.S. Department of Energy predicts that if such trends continue unchecked, America's foreign oil imports will rise to 62% by the year 2020, half of which will come from the increasingly unstable and hostile Middle East. Now, over the past few years, I've talked to all kinds of experts on this subject, including current and former Energy and Interior Secretaries, both Republicans and Democrats. And I've also talked to the radical environmentalists and the anti-growth crowd. Along the way, I've sifted through the rhetoric and the facts and concluded that we have an incredible opportunity right in front of us if only we seize the day. If we choose to, America can achieve true energy freedom. But first, we must overcome the left's propaganda and obstructionism and proceed based upon the facts. And right now, the U.S. has about 21 billion barrels of proven oil reserve, and estimates by the 1995 U.S. Geological Survey indicate that we have, quote, technically recoverable oil resource base onshore of more than 110 billion barrels. Moreover, we have more than 1.2 trillion cubic feet of natural gas reserves, which when developed would last us for more than three decades. At the heart of any such energy freedom strategy is the development of just a tiny sliver of ANWR. Of the 19 million acres that make up the entire Arctic refuge, Congress has set aside a mere 1.5 million acres for potential oil exploration and development. That's less than 8% of the total. The Bush administration, however, isn't seeking to develop all 19 million acres or even all 1.5 million acres. The Bush plan calls for exploration on a mere 2,000 acres. Now, that means 99.99% of the land surface will be untouched, or just 1/100th of 1%. Moreover, the state-of-the-art developments in modern drilling technology now allow for a minimal amount of land and equipment to be used above ground. Petroleum engineers can put a hole in the ground in one place and drill sideways as well as down, severely limiting man's quote-unquote footprint on environmentally sensitive areas. New technologies mean energy development is no longer a zero-sum game. We no longer face a choice between our energy and economic needs and the environment. We can and should protect both. The results of such high-tech development would be impressive, to say the least. The U.S. Geological Survey studies indicate that we could count on up to 16 billion barrels of oil from Anwar. That's about as much as we'd otherwise import from Saudi Arabia over the next 30 years, making it well worth the effort. Now, meanwhile, it's important to keep in mind that Anwar is not exactly a bastion of tourism and trade, nor is it among America's most pristine and gorgeous wilderness areas. It's actually barren and practically uninhabitable. Senator Frank Murkowski, an Alaska Republican, notes that Anwar is, quote, flat, treeless, almost featureless plain, where there are 56 days of total darkness during the year and almost 9 months of harsh winter. Now, while humans can barely survive there, it's true that the porcupine caribou are among the few animals that can both survive and thrive. But the development of 0.01% of the land clearly won't destroy the caribou's habitat. And this isn't just idle speculation. We have some empirical evidence that bears on the issue. When we develop oil fields on Alaska's nearby North Slope in Prudhoe Bay, for example, the caribou population there flourished. In fact, the Central Arctic caribou herd that inhabits parts of Prudhoe Bay has grown from 6,000 in 1978 to 19,700 today, notes Senator Murkowski, citing the most recent estimates by state and federal wildlife agencies. Columnist George Will has pointed out that there is drilling for oil and gas in 29 wildlife areas without destroying animals, birds, fish, or the rest of the environment. Conservatives in Congress are even willing to give the Secretary of Interior the power to stop oil development and exploration during the summer if the caribou are ever truly threatened. Conservatives passed such legislation back in 1995, but President Clinton vetoed the measure. The evidence demonstrates overwhelmingly that the left's argument for protecting the porcupine caribou, the musk ox, and the polar bear in Anwar is a red herring. It's one more partisan political diversion designed to derail oil exploration and development anywhere, not just in Alaska, but off the California and Florida coasts, in the Gulf of Mexico, in the Great Lakes, and on most public lands. I once interviewed Deb Callahan of the League of Conservation Voters on Hannity and Combs, and she spelled out the radical environmentalist case beautifully. After she insisted that, quote, opening Anwar is a very poor idea, I challenged her to offer an alternative. Quote, would you support drilling in the lower 48 states or not? Would you support drilling off the coast of California or Florida or not? I mean, which of these areas would you support drilling, if any? Quote, that was a big area you just sort of laid out there, she stammered. But first of all, well, pick one, I pressed. I mean, tell me where you'd support drilling. She goes, well, let me talk about environmentalists supporting energy production and energy facilities. For instance, in California. You can't name me one place you'd support drilling, can you? I asked. Well, she wouldn't name one place where she'd support drilling for new sources of oil and natural gas. And the best she would do is say that she wasn't for shutting down oil exploration, drilling, production, and shipping facilities in Prudhoe Bay. Do we think Prudhoe Bay should be shut down? She asked rhetorically. No. Of course, that wasn't the question. When Alan sat down for a one-on-one interview on Hannity and Combs with Tom Daschle in February of 2002, Alan, to his credit, asked Daschle directly, is the president right to tie the issue of oil drilling to national security? We can't go back, Alan, to the old days of simply finding places to drill, Daschle replied. We're running out of places to drill in this country, but we can make much more efficient use of what we're using. Despite the fact that those bad old days helped fuel America's industrial revolution and created the most prosperous economy on the face of the earth, no one is proposing lifting or suspending legitimate environmental requirements in the search for new sources of oil and gas, and Daschle knows that. No one is proposing using old technologies to explore for fossil fuels when new technologies exist, and no one is proposing changing the American landscape with oil rigs. Agreeing with him completely, Alan then asked Daschle, why this mania about drilling in the small area? What's that about? Quote, well, I think what's behind it is just a mindset that many have had for generations that you go where the oil is regardless of the circumstances, Daschle answered. What we have learned is that you can't always go where the oil is, especially in cases when there's so little oil there in the first place and where it doesn't provide more than about a six-month supply of oil in the United States, and it isn't worth destroying permanently our most precious natural resources, we're not going to go to Anwar. Note that Daschle was completely unencumbered by the facts. As we've seen, drilling in Anwar would result in the destruction of no precious natural resources, much less permanently. But being hostage to their environmental constituencies, Democrats feel compelled to spew their destructive nonsense. And I do mean nonsense. They are the same people who painted Bush as a sadistic menace trying to poison our drinking water with arsenic merely because he spent a few months considering all the facts and deliberating carefully instead of making a knee-jerk decision on arsenic standards, standards, by the way, that were in place throughout the Clinton and Gore years and before. And to think this man is not only the Senate Majority Leader and the highest-ranking official in the Democratic Party, but he actually fancies himself a presidential timber. In a separate interview I had with Democratic Senator John Kerry, Kerry articulated his philosophical objection to pursuing oil drilling anywhere to solve our energy needs. He touted the benefits of solar power, wind power, hydroelectric power, and other alternative sources of energy. And all that is fine, but just because Kerry or any other politician or activist imagines or demands these supposed energy alternatives doesn't make them economically viable either now or in the future. What you have are two different visions, Senator Kerry told me. The vision that has been expressed in the House legislation and the White House is one that depends on drilling our way out of our current problem. Well, that's part of their solution, I agreed, and I know that Vice President, Kerry tried to interrupt. Wait a minute, I said. I know Vice President Dick Cheney offered a series of solutions last year. The vast majority talked about conservation. We have Gail Norton. She's been right here between us, right here on this program, and said some estimates have the Arctic Wildlife Reserve, where we'd only deal with 0.001% of the refuge, only 2,000 acres, that it could be the second largest oil find in American history, and we could do it without harming the wildlife in any way, which is what we've been able to do at Prudhoe Bay. My only point is, you know, we've tried to perfect this alternative technology, solar, wind power, for decades, and we have not, obviously, been that successful. And the Clinton-Gore administration had 8 years to implement some of these new sources of energy. They weren't successful. If we want energy independence, I think part of that comprehensive plan has got to include lessening our dependence on foreign oil and tapping into that resource in Alaska. Well, what you said is partly correct, Kerry responded. Yes, we have to lessen our dependence on foreign oil. The problem is tapping into whatever might exist in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge does nothing to wean you from oil. It merely continues the dependency. It's like a narcotic, he said. If you're on the narcotic, get more of it and don't worry about the alternative. We don't need to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, at least now, in order to provide for the energy needs of our country. Now, it's difficult to point to another issue in modern American history where a major political party's rhetoric is so divorced from the reality, but let's think logically about this for a moment. Can you imagine how many solar panels, how many windmills would be required to replace our country's consumption of more traditional forms of energy? Even if it were feasible, where would we put them? In all those pristine places where the radical environmentalists claim to want to protect nature? Can you imagine the outcries then? Can you imagine the kind of financial resources that would be required by homeowners and businesses and public facilities and public utilities and the like to convert our nation's energy infrastructure to deliver, receive, and make otherwise usable these new forms of energy? And if these alternatives are truly viable and reasonable, why haven't any of the other major industrial nations, including Europe's socialist regimes and Japan, successfully instituted them? Kerry and his fellow liberals are not only tilting at windmills, they're obstructing America's future economic growth and prosperity. Indeed, we would be doing them a substantial disservice just to take them seriously. Their ideas are so ill-advised that reasonableness requires us to assume something other than what they claim is motivating them. For if we accept their ideas at face value, we have no choice but to conclude that even in those most dangerous of times, they would take us straight back to the Carter vintage energy crisis. Where then do we go from here? In March of 2002, Allen and I interviewed Gail Norton, President Bush's Interior Secretary, on Hannity and Combs. Secretary Norton commented that the administration was, quote, working to have a bipartisan approach to solving problems for this country, but it is a little frustrating when we see things that get bogged down because of partisanship. Liberals, quote, are not only against the wildlife refuge for drilling, I noted, they're also against it in the Gulf of Mexico. They're against drilling off the coast of California and Florida. Left-wing groups are opposed to drilling in the Great Lakes, drilling in the wilderness and the parklands. They oppose nuclear power. They're against hydroelectric power plants. They don't want the construction of pipelines. I mean, I think the only thing left is like a little battery-operated Yugo. She agreed, but said the Bush administration would continue looking for constructive ways to work with congressional Democrats for the sake of the country. Quote, we've been working hard to try and find those places where there's strong support for energy development going forward, Secretary Norton told me. And actually, the state of Alaska is somewhat unique with its approach to ANWR because they do strongly support the ANWR proposal in Alaska. They want to see the energy development in their backyards. Americans now know how important it is to expand domestic energy resources. 8 in 10 Americans, for example, believe the U.S. is likely to experience a serious energy crisis within the next few years, while 36% believe the U.S. is already in one, according to a Worthland poll taken in March of 2001. Nearly 8 in 10 Americans say they want more oil produced here at home, and more than 6 in 10 have said that they support development in ANWR when they understand the facts. In fact, despite the left's deceptions, more than 75% of Alaskans support oil development in ANWR. Eskimos are also big supporters. The mayor of Alaska's North Slope borough, part of ANWR, takes offense at liberal notions that he and his fellow Eskimos can't choose what's best for themselves, their families, and their land. Quote, we know that development of energy in ANWR is a responsible use of the land, the mayor says. For thousands of years, we've had a reverence for the land, and part of our fundamental belief is that the land should be used responsibly. Conservation has always been a part of our culture, the mayor adds. Our people have been respectfully using the land long before Columbus discovered America. People who have never been to Alaska but are opposing ANWR oil development need to visit and speak to us. Alaska's Governor Tony Knowles, a Democrat, is a particularly big supporter of drilling in ANWR. He broke ranks with his party precisely because he knows the facts. Allen and I invited Governor Knowles on Hannity and Combs to talk about ANWR, and it was a good conversation. The governor is a very knowledgeable guy, and he's on the right side of this critically important issue. But Allen, of course, simply refused to take the word of an Alaskan Democrat that it is indeed possible to strike a healthy balance among energy security, jobs, and economic growth, and protecting the environment. Instead, he went after President Bush. Quote, should we be looking at the fact that George W. Bush got more than $1.7 million in campaign contributions from oil and gas companies, including BP and ExxonMobil, two of the biggest companies that do business in Alaska? Allen asks. They always say follow the money. Well, they're doing that with Clinton. Should that be part of the equation here? The governor responded with a zinger. Quote, well, I think you need to ask the senior citizen that was being pried from an elevator during one of the rolling blackouts in California as to whether we should develop our oil and gas in America so we can provide energy for families and for jobs, the governor responded. Union workers and their leadership also support drilling in ANWR. Quote, by tapping into petroleum resources in Alaska, we can create jobs and stabilize our economy by lessening our dependence on foreign oil, said Teamster President James P. Hoffa, explaining that developing ANWR could create more than 735,000 new jobs. American jobs and environmental protection are not mutually exclusive. Alaskan oil fields currently use the most environmentally sensitive technology in the world. Only a small part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge would be used. Again, only about 2,000 acres, roughly one-fifth the size of Washington's Dulles Airport. The Teamsters, which represent more than 1.5 million workers in the U.S. and Canada, endorsed Al Gore in 2000. But in 2001, after President Bush, Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, and Interior Secretary Gail Norton courted them and invited them to join forces, the Teamsters backed the Bush energy plan. And when the radical environmental groups used Martin Sheen, a.k.a. the president on NBC's The West Wing, to cut a commercial opposing oil development in Alaska, Jerry Hood, a top Teamster official, had some choice words. Quote, I couldn't think of a more perfect champion for these pretend facts than a pretend president, he quipped. The environmental lobby have repeated these half-truths for months, hoping that will make them true. I joined President Bush in calling on the Senate to pass a comprehensive energy policy now, Hood added. More than ever, we should listen to the commander-in-chief, whose Oval Office is located in Washington, D.C., not Hollywood. President Bush campaigned on the promise of making this country more energy independent and trying to achieve a reasonable balance between our environmental concerns and the nation's energy needs. And to fulfill that promise, he offered a serious and responsible plan, the first such plan in over a decade. When he unveiled his plan in May of 2001, however, environmental activists went ballistic. In protest, Greenpeace dumped a truckload of coal in the driveway of Vice President Cheney's official residence. But neither Cheney nor Bush was deterred. Indeed, Bush proved that he was not going to be intimidated by those opposing ANWR drilling when he made it a centerpiece of his plan. This signaled a refreshing departure from the Clinton years. It is critical that we conservatives ultimately triumph on the energy issue, because, as with so many others, it will determine what kind of country we leave the next generation. And the danger we face from failing to become energy independent cannot be overstated. Decades of liberal no-growth policies have seriously endangered our economic and our national security, and the problem is only getting worse. We all ought to be concerned by the incremental encroachments of our federal government and the freedoms they are eroding. Here's an axiomatic truth. The more expansive government becomes, the more difficult it is to dismantle. Part of the reason is that even many of those who might be generally opposed to big government become dependent on government benefits, creating cycles of dependency. This can be difficult to break, though not impossible, as recent experience, for example, has shown with welfare reform. The cost of federal, state, and local government in America has exceeded the $3 trillion mark, wrote economist Steve Moore in February 2002 in a study entitled The Most Expensive Government in World History. Quote, not only does the United States spend more than the entire economy of France, but government spends more money in just a single year than it spent combined from 1781 to 1900, even after adjusting for inflation. Moore, who's one of the brightest and most insightful policy analysts in Washington today, notes that while government consumed about 5% of America's national income during the days of FDR's New Deal, well, today government consumes between 20 and 25% of our entire national income. And worse, over the course of the next 5 years, the federal government alone is expected to spend more money than was spent on World Wars I, II, Civil War, and the Revolutionary War, even after adjusting for inflation. So what does that mean in practical terms? Well, Moore puts it this way. In 1900, total taxes per household were $1,900 using constant $2,000. In 1950, total taxes per household were $11,000. In 1999, total taxes per household reached $30,000. During the Clinton-Gore years, the federal tax burden alone grew by a staggering 45% from an average of $4,625 per person to about $6,690 per person. Moreover, we pay taxes on almost everything we do. There are federal income taxes, Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes, corporate taxes, federal airline taxes, gas taxes, cigarette taxes, alcohol taxes, and a dizzying array of excise taxes and fees. If that weren't enough, there are state income taxes, local taxes, sales taxes, property taxes, hotel taxes, water taxes, electric taxes, phone taxes, and on and on and on. Even when you're dead, your heirs have to pay the death tax, a tax that from its inception has never been anything other than a socialistic measure primarily aimed not at producing revenues, but confiscating private property, a linchpin of political and economic liberty and redistribution of wealth. The cold truth is that the American taxpayer, that's you, is being abused and plundered by its own government. And it's no wonder, then, that a full 65% of Americans polled in October of 2000, just before the Bush-Gore election, said that they were overtaxed. Nor is it any wonder that even in the months following 9/11, more Americans told pollsters that they feared an IRS audit than anthrax. As the late conservative icon Barry Goldwater once put it, the income tax created more criminals than any other single act of government. President Bush has remained true to his campaign pledge in leading the fight for tax cuts. Without question, the $1.3 trillion tax cut plan passed in the summer of 2001 has been the boldest part of Bush's domestic agenda, and it has taken no small amount of courage and resolve on his part. Both during the presidential campaign and after, the left assailed Bush for seeking to reduce marginal tax rates and abolish the death tax. They accused him of seeking to bless the rich and soak the poor, courting big business instead of the little folks, and lining the pockets of special interests at the expense of mom and pop. Jimmy Carter left office with the American economy sinking fast, soaring unemployment, double-digit inflation, double-digit interest rates, a contracting economy, a loss of national self-confidence, and a sense that America's best days might be behind her. That was the bad news. The good news was that Ronald Reagan's economic leadership and the dramatic tax cuts set into motion one of the greatest peacetime economic expansions in American history. For seven straight years, U.S. economic growth averaged 4%. Inflation plummeted, interest rates were cut in half, nearly 20 million new jobs were created, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average shot up an amazing 240% as new businesses flourished and middle-income Americans saw their pension plans create significant wealth. Did the Reagan tax cuts cause the deficits of the 1980s? Not at all. In fact, government revenue nearly doubled during the Reagan years. No, the deficits of the 1980s were caused by the insatiable spending demands of congressional Democrats, particularly the Democratic-controlled House. Did Reagan's tax cuts steal from the poor and give to the rich? Not at all. The rich did pay lower rates as a result of the marginal rate tax reductions, but because the economy flourished and more wealth was created, the richest Americans actually ended up paying a higher percentage of the total tax burden. In fact, economist Bruce Bartlett notes that in 1983, the total effective federal tax rate on the wealthiest 1% of Americans paid was 26.8%, but by 2000, it had climbed to 32.7%. At the same time, the effective tax rate on the poorest 20% of Americans dropped from 8.1% in 1983 to just 5.3%. So the next time you hear some liberal, somebody on the left, complain about the 1980s, be ready with the facts to challenge them. I've interviewed Republican presidential contender Steve Forbes and House Majority Leader Dick Armey countless times, and the more I listen to these men, the more convinced I am that it's time to scrap this corrupt and indefensible federal income tax code. Either a flat tax or a national sales tax would be preferable to the current mess, but personally, I lean a little bit more towards the flat tax. And we should start with something like a generous personal exemption of, say, $15,000 for each adult, $5,000 for each child, and that would mean that a family of four would pay no federal income tax on their first $40,000 of income, which would amount to a tax cut of between $1,000 and $2,000 for many Americans. Above the personal exemptions, we should tax income at a single fixed rate, say 15% or 17%, allowing deductions for only charitable contributions and home mortgage interest payments. Abolish the tax on capital gains, abolish the marriage penalty, abolish the alternative minimum tax, abolish taxes on savings and investment, abolish the death tax permanently, not with some outrageous sunset provision that will only bring it back in a few years. If you allow for immediate expensing of capital equipment for business, and we should create a tax form no bigger than a postcard or a single sheet of paper. A flat tax would be simple to use. It would take about 5 minutes to complete. A flat tax would be fair. Everyone would be treated equally under the law. And moreover, by removing the dead weight of 5.8 billion hours and 194 billion a year wasted in tax preparation and compliance, the flat tax would be pro-growth. Economists of all stripes agree that it would bring interest rates down, and they also agree it would unleash a serious economic boom. We would very likely see America's long-term and consistent economic growth rates average upwards of 4% to 5% a year. That, in turn, would cause government revenues to soar, providing much-needed additional funds to strengthen Medicare and save Social Security. A flat tax would also prevent the torment of intimidating audits and would decriminalize honest mistakes resulting from the complexity of the current code. Since January 2001, even formerly communist Russia has embraced a 13% flat tax, and it's lower than any other country in Europe, and it's certainly lower than here, and guess what? It's working. As Russians pay far lower rates than they've ever had before, they're working harder, creating more, and experiencing strong economic growth. In 2001 alone, some 400,000 new businesses were created, up 11%, and tax revenues soared a whopping 47%. The fact is, tax rate cuts work every time they're tried, no matter what the country or state for that matter. But the question remains whether those of us who are trumpeting this truth will ultimately prevail in the war of ideas, or will we be defeated by the boundless demagoguery of those who have a vested interest in distorting the truth? I believe we have reason to be optimistic. If we follow the lead of Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, who overcame the class warfare tactics of the left by taking our case directly to the American people, there's no reason we can't succeed. If there's one thing I've learned in my time in radio and television, it's this. It makes no difference how good your product or service is if you don't effectively market it. In the war of ideas, conservatives have great products to sell. On the whole range of issues, from intelligence to immigration and national security to education and energy and taxation, conservatives have better ideas than liberals. They have superior prescriptions for governance, for solving society's problems, and maximizing freedom. The Republican Party is the vehicle through which conservative ideas have the best chance of thriving. Reciprocally, the Republican Party has its best chance of thriving by adhering to the precepts of conservatism. To the extent that Republican leaders have over time embraced a bold and principled brand of conservatism, they've been successful politically and in advancing their own agenda. But when they have diluted their message for the sake of appeasing the center, they have suffered politically, and their agenda has been compromised. Liberal Democrats, by contrast, have largely lost the idealism they once had. Their ideas of big government have been in disfavor for some time, especially since the fall of the Soviet Empire. Whereas Republicans have generally benefited from remaining true to conservative ideals, Democratic presidential contenders have discovered that embracing full-blown liberalism has been the kiss of death for their political aspirations, for example, McGovern or Mondale. Bill Clinton both secured his party's nomination and won the general election by adopting the more centrist agenda of the Democratic Leadership Council. Often, when he governed to the left, he alienated the electorate. By trying to ram the Hillary Care health care debacle down the nation's throat, he handed the Republicans a congressional majority for the first time in 40 years. And some of the things for which Clinton has received the greatest acclaim and for which he has taken credit were conservative policies enacted over his strenuous and repeated objections, balancing the budget and welfare reform among them. So to a great extent, the Democratic Party is no longer a party of ideas. Instead, it has become the party of invective. Its divisiveness and demagoguery have little new to offer beyond expanding the welfare state. The Democrats talk a great game of compassion, but can never explain what is compassionate about increasing government dependency and eroding our liberties. That said, however, conservatives face a major problem. While conservatives have better ideas, liberals are generally better at politics by a long shot. They play to win, they take no prisoners. In the process, they often play dirty and dishonestly. Republicans face the challenge of fighting Democrats effectively without adopting their ruthless tactics. Now, that's a tall but necessary order. The first step is for Republicans to shed their collective naivete and realize that they're in the fight of their lives. They can aspire to a new tone all they want, but a coming together takes two, and the other side is offering nothing but the politics of personal destruction. Republicans can retain their decency, but they've got to fight, accepting the difficult challenge of fighting a clean fight against an opponent who plays dirty. Remember back in November of 1994, when voters swept Democrats out and Republicans into control of the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate, liberals were absolutely stunned and desperate. They'd been so good at politics for so long, dominating the debate and control of Congress for decades, that it probably never occurred to many of them that they might one day lose power. faced with the overwhelming rejection of voters who preferred the smaller government agenda put forth in the Republicans' contract with America, the Democrats unleashed a hysterical propaganda campaign. House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt, not surprisingly, he led the charge. Just 1 month after the Republican landslide, he branded Newt Gingrich and his fellow conservatives a, quote, band of trickle-down terrorists. He said conservatives would use a tried and tested GOP formula of division, exclusion, and fear to implement their contract on America, apparently likening conservatives to a bloodthirsty mafia family. When they swerve to the extreme, we'll champion the mainstream, Gephardt said in a speech broadcast live on CNN. When they fly off to fiscal fantasy land, we'll guard America's real homes and jobs and families. When they stump for the wealthy, we'll stand for the workers, the people whose interests can't be protected by a Star Wars defense disaster. And when they try to impose the radical views of the few on all of America, we'll fight for the core responsibilities of work and responsibility and tolerance and diversity that always have been the creed of family life. And when they try to punish and pigeonhole those of us who are the most vulnerable, we'll work to prepare them to give them real opportunities. And when they try to rewrite the Constitution of the United States in a flash of ideological ink, we'll tell them thanks, but no thanks. Our founding fathers got it right the first time. Over the next few months, their vitriol got even worse. President Clinton said conservatives want to, quote, make war on the kids of this country, unquote. White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta said conservatives want to, quote, literally take meals from kids and run over kids. Representative Charlie Rangel likened conservatives to Adolf Hitler. Mario Cuomo likened conservatives to Nazi stormtroopers. Representative Jose Serrano, the New York Democrat, unloaded on conservatives and their, quote, mean-spirited, reactionary, insensitive, indifferent, right-wing, extremist, anti-poor, anti-children, Constitution-bashing, bordering on racist contract on America. Simultaneously, the left-wing media dutifully chimed in. One nationally syndicated columnist devoted an entire column to, quote, why conservatives don't deserve respect, arguing that no matter how smart or literate or successful they are, conservatives do not deserve cultural affirmation. A local columnist in Denver couldn't simply disagree with Republican Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell on the issue of campaign finance reform. She also felt compelled to attack him personally by mocking his Native American heritage, describing him as a, quote, pimp in a headdress. National Public Radio's Nina Totenberg made this outrageous statement about Senator Jesse Helms, the conservatives' conservative from North Carolina. Quote, I think he ought to be worried about what's going on in the good Lord's mind, because if there's retributive justice, he'll get AIDS from a transfusion, or one of his grandchildren will get it. As if that weren't enough, Hollywood got into the act. Barbara Streisand, for example, gave a speech at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government attacking Newt Gingrich, Jesse Helms, Rush Limbaugh, and the Christian Coalition. She ripped conservatives as the far right, a dangerous group who were unwilling to tackle tough issues like racism, sexism, and global injustices like the Holocaust. A few years later, as the House of Representatives was impeaching Clinton for his high crimes and misdemeanors, appearing on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, Alec Baldwin said, quote, if we were in other countries, all of us together would go down to Washington and we would stone Henry Hyde to death. We would stone him to death. We would stone him to death. And we would go to their homes, we'd kill their wives and their children, we would kill their families. As you might imagine, Representative Hyde, one of the most honorable and decent members of the United States Congress, wasn't amused. Quote, excuse me for not laughing, he told reporters. Baldwin wants my family stoned to death by a mob. Imagine if a Republican had said such a thing. This incident was instructive for at least two reasons. One is that it absolutely caused no flap among the cultural elite. Only conservatives were appalled at Baldwin's ravings, proving once again that the liberals' self-proclaimed tolerance is a farce. Their tolerance extends to ideas and people of which they approve and no further, which means it's not tolerance at all. Among the tolerant left, there's no respect, much less protection, for conservatives and their ideas. The other lesson we can glean from this is, despite their claims to have the corner on compassion, many liberals are capable of singular viciousness. One may protest that I'm being unfair for drawing broader conclusions from this. After all, it was only one actor spouting off. That would be true, but for the facts that, one, Baldwin was not condemned by his ideological colleagues, and two, he's still respected in liberal circles, and three, there are plenty more with tongues as sharp as his. Another sharp tongue was unleashed on CBS's Late Show with Craig Kilborn in August of 2000 when a violent graphic flashed briefly on the screen. The word "snipers wanted" was superimposed over footage of George W. Bush accepting the Republican nomination at his party's convention in Philadelphia. CBS, after being bombarded with complaints, reluctantly acknowledged that the graphic was inappropriate and regrettable, and that CBS and the program's producer, Worldwide Pants Inc., would investigate it. Bush, in his usual gracious way, accepted the apology and said he looked forward to seeing the results of CBS's investigation. You can rest assured that had Al Gore been the subject of the clip, heads would have rolled at CBS. One of the most reprehensible cards in the left's deck is the race card, by the way. During the 1998 congressional elections, the Democratic Party ran an incredibly malicious anti-Republican radio ad in Missouri. "When you don't vote, you allow another cross to burn," said a male announcer. "When you don't vote, you let another assault wound a brother or sister. When you don't vote, you let the Republicans continue to cut school lunches and Head Start. When you don't vote, you allow the Republicans to give tax breaks to the wealthy while threatening Social Security and Medicare. Do vote and you elect Democrats who want to strengthen Social Security and Medicare, make classes small by hiring 100,000 new teachers, and repair and rebuild public schools. When you vote, you elect Democrats committed to a patient's bill of rights that lets us, not the insurance companies, make choices about our health care. Voting will change things for the better. On November 3rd, vote. Vote smart. Vote Democrat for Congress and the U.S. Senate." A female announcer then concluded, "Paid for by Missouri Democratic Party, Donna Knight, treasurer." While the cynicism of this tactic speaks for itself, there was no apology, much less a retraction from Democrats when confronted by Republicans. This Democratic Party, which prides itself in promoting civility among people and races, didn't even bother to distance itself from this discourse. On Hannity and Combs, I confronted Michael Brown, son of the late Clinton Commerce Secretary Ron Brown, about the despicable race-baiting tactics his party uses, such as that cross-burning radio ad. "Michael, aren't you ashamed that your party ran an ad like that?" I asked him. "No, actually, I guess I see why you're disappointed," Brown told me. "I mean, the facts hurt." "You should be ashamed." "I'm not ashamed at all," he shot back. "So you vote for a Republican and another cross is going to burn," I pressed. "Well, that's the one sentence you pick out. They talked about specific issues." "Are you ashamed of that one sentence?" I pressed again. "Look," he said, "the Democratic Party has fought so hard for the American people, and the Republican Party has not," Brown responded. "They have never, never will. Sean, I may even agree with you that one of those lines may not be the best thing to do in an ad like that, but the facts are accurate." Well, what facts? This ad was clearly directed at potential African-American voters. It consisted of an admonition to vote Democratic, preceded by four racially charged, scaremongering statements grossly mischaracterizing the likely impact of Republican policies. According to the ad, voting Republican promotes cross-burning, the commission of violent crimes against blacks, the slashing of the school lunch program, Head Start, Social Security, Medicare, and redistribution of tax revenues from the poor to the rich. Are those the facts to which Mr. Brown was referring? It's utterly shameless in my view. Another recent example of liberal race baiting was a television ad from the 2000 election season in which the NAACP tried to link George W. Bush to the sickening dragging death of a black man named James Byrd in Texas. "I'm Renee Mullins, James Byrd's daughter," the ad begins. "On June 7, 1998, in Texas, my father was killed. He was beaten, chained, and then dragged 3 miles to his death, all because he was black. So when Governor George W. Bush refused to support hate crimes legislation, it was like my father was killed all over again. Call George W. Bush and tell him to support hate crimes legislation. We won't be dragged away from our future." Now, first of all, my heart goes out to the Byrd family. I can't imagine the pain and anguish that they've been through. when the three men responsible for that evil act were arrested, convicted, and sentenced. Two will die by lethal injection. The third will spend the rest of his life in prison. No one cheered louder than I. That said, this ad was contemptible. It's one of the meanest ads I've ever seen in politics, and unfortunately, I'll tell you, I predict more of the same in 2002, 2004, and beyond. Conservatives did not kill James Byrd, but thanks to conservative support for Texas's death penalty law, which, if liberals had their way, would not exist, two of James Byrd's killers are to be executed with the support of George W. Bush. It should be noted that among the other reasons conservatives oppose so-called hate crimes legislation is that they aspire to a colorblind society, not one constantly steeped in the degrading mire of color consciousness. They believe that by constantly placing race at the forefront of the national debate, we are reverting to the place from which Martin Luther King sought deliverance for blacks, that is, a society where men are judged by the color of their skin, not the content of their character. But Democrats have so effectively demonized Republicans with the race card that they often are too intimidated to oppose race-conscious measures like affirmative action laws or these hate crime bills for fear of being falsely branded as bigots. That's probably why many Senate Republicans conspired with Democrats in 1999 to pass, under the anonymity of voice vote, the Hate Crimes Prevention Act. Just the previous year, enough Senate Republicans opposed the bill, and in some cases vocally, to prevent its passage, but that was before the James Byrd murder and the fatal flogging of a gay college student in Wyoming and the shooting spree in Illinois and Indiana by a man allegedly part of a white supremacist group. Democrats are brilliant at parlaying such incidents to their political advantage. Everyone knows that hate crimes legislation would not have prevented James Byrd's death by the savages that dragged him to death. But that didn't matter to the Democrats, who shamelessly used these atrocities as a catalyst for their divisive legislation. They employed precisely the same tactic in their efforts to pass gun control legislation. Clinton used the Columbine massacre, knowing that the perpetrators broke more than 60 existing laws, and the legislation he was proposing would have no deterrent effect on the killers. Ditto with campaign finance legislation. Democrats used the Enron scandal to rally support for this bill, despite the fact that Enron disproved the driving theory of reform, i.e. that money leads to access and corruption. With Enron, it is clear that the Bush administration did not tailor its policy in favor of the corporate